Mr. Wrigley speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time first to check in with Indiana Week in Review. It's hosted by Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. And those who listen to the program or watch the program on public television stations know that they're getting the answers from Indiana Week in Review and what's been described as a no-holds-barred debate and discussion. This week on Indiana Week in Review, the panel's taking a look at Hoosier politics in 2018. The DCS is asking for nearly $300 million. Mike Pence stays silent in an Oval Office squabble. That and more, including Governor Holcomb trying to clarify his views on teacher pay and more. And here's the conversation.
A look back at 2018, Indiana's U.S. Senate race, the blue wave that wasn't in the Hoosier state. That, plus Curtis Hill, Sunday Sales, and more on Indiana Week in Review. This week, we look back at the Hoosier political landscape in 2018. Indiana's critical U.S. Senate race dominated the discussion and the airwaves this year. Democratic incumbent Joe Donnelly faced a tough re-election bid in a state Donald Trump won by 19 points just 2 years before. His principal opponent, auto parts magnate and former state lawmaker Mike Braun, who knocked off a pair of congressmen, Luke Messer and Todd Rokita, in the GOP primary. Braun emerged victorious as national Republicans increased their majority margin in the Senate. So did Mike Braun win this race, or did Joe Donnelly lose it? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, can Democrats win on the statewide level in Indiana anymore?
You know, I know you're young, okay, but I have heard that before. I've heard that Democrats could never win at the state level. I've heard that Republicans were dead in Indiana. So, you know,
haven't heard
these
that
things,
one in a while, to be fair.
These, you haven't in a while, but those pendulums swing back and forth and will be relevant again at the statewide level. We've got a lot of good mayors in a lot of big towns in this state, and, you know, we'll be fine. And, you know, you have to give credit. Mike Braun won. Joe Donnelly managed to pull off 13% of the Trump voters, making it a lot closer. So there's a lot more people in Indiana who had gone with Trump in 2016 who aren't so sure now. And what they traded was a hardworking senator who put the needs of Hoosiers first for a rubber stamp for Donald Trump. So we'll see how that plays out in the future for Mike Braun. But it's clear that Joe worked very hard and came very close, relatively speaking. And Democrats will be back. You just wait.
Obviously, in the immediate aftermath of the election, a lot of the talk was, well, now the Democrats don't have any statewide elected office holders, and the initial margin of victory seemed pretty significant. But when all was said and done, it was just 51% that Mike Braun won. Is that a decisive victory in your mind?
I think it is, and clearly the margin, because of the margin. But you know, the math on a 13% drawdown isn't totally clean, because it's a presidential electorate versus a midterm electorate, and the voter mix is different. Clearly, Democrats.
And usually, more Republicans vote in midterm elections.
Well, I think Democrats did a good job here of mobilizing in the suburbs. I think what you've seen is when I first started working in politics in Hendricks County, when Mitch Daniels first ran his first time in Hendricks County, George W. Bush got 70-75% of the vote. Mitch was right up there with him, and over the course of time, we've seen those numbers come down. Where if in the donut counties, you got the kind of margins that that you would have had 12 or 14 years ago, it would have signaled you might lose statewide. But what we've seen over the course of the last 12 or 14 years is, especially in southern Indiana and all those border or all those river districts, all the local elected officials have flipped over to Republicans. Voters have changed their voter identification, their self-identification from 100-year Democrat, Dixie Democrats, to Republicans. We have all of those seats now. I think the biggest number right now, the most impactful number for me right now is the number of local elected officials we have that Republicans have in Indiana, where we have 92% of the county commissioners, for example.
How many of the mayors?
64? 65?
No, it's
big.
It's quite that high.
It's getting, yeah.
It's a big number. It's come down since the historic high in 2014.
15.
But we still have a majority, and we still have good, great mayors and a great bench of elected officials going forward.
Donald Trump was here twice in the 3 or 4 days before the election, and this was obviously always going to be a close race. It turned into a close race, though it didn't seem that way a little bit on election night when it was called pretty early, a lot earlier than a lot of people expected. Do you think he had a measurable impact in how this ended up?
I think he benefited Mike Braun, certainly. Not that he did everywhere he went. Certainly there were other states across the country where it was probably a negative. And in fact, alienated some Republicans and probably energized Democratic voters. So I'm not saying that Donald Trump is a net plus wherever he went this past general election in the days leading up to the balloting, but I think it probably it didn't hurt. Certainly Mike Braun in Indiana.
I said, did Mike Braun win? Did Joe Donnelly lose? When you talk about a candidate losing. But in your mind, could Joe Donnelly have done anything else than what he did to try and win this seat?
Well, obviously, the big question is whether he aligned himself too much with Trump and away from core Democratic, you know, stances. I think that is the big question. We just don't know whether he went too far the other way.
Well, Governor Eric Holcomb's 2018 was dominated in part by issues at the Department of Child Services. It started with explosive allegations in former director Mary Beth Bonaventura's resignation letter. One charge, she said children would die because of Holcomb's management and policies. An independent investigation delivered a series of recommendations for the agency, some of which have been implemented, while many others are still in process. And the agency recently delivered its funding request for the new budget, nearly $300 million more per year than it got in the last budget to meet the one-time spending they've got in the last year and a half. Mike O'Brien, should Hoosiers be satisfied with the progress at DCS?
I think so. If you look at where we started the year, Hoosiers have a governor who faced a big problem and hit it head on. He didn't make excuses for it. Implement a study to get the facts. That report delivered recommendations that are now being implemented. We're about to deliver a historic amount of funding to that agency. We're already seeing progress. We're seeing caseloads come down. We're seeing higher pay for the caseworkers themselves and the other staff at DCS that were underpaid and overworked for a long time. And we're seeing an increase in adoptions because that's been an area of focus, a 23% increase year over year. So the metrics on the things that can be improved right now are moving the right direction. But a lot of this is also, we didn't have a legislative session between here and there, so now we have a long one. We have a budget session where funding is going to be increased by half a billion dollars. And some of the other moving parts of that agency are controlled by state law. For example, the caseload ratios are controlled by state law, so you've got to go in and actually make changes to that in order to try to get into them. So
some of the stuff that's pending, the recommendations, are things that
the legislature has to act on and will act on. Right. And so we'll see very specific legislation going forward this session to make improvements to those areas. So it was a bad problem to start out with, but it's been made much better in the last year.
Nothing in state government turns on a dime. So in terms of the progress you've seen at
DCS. They've made progress. There's no question they've made progress. But this problem has been out there for a long time. I mean, it's been out there under Mitch Daniels. And all of these years, we've looked at it and looked at it and looked at it, and things didn't get done because the money wasn't allocated, because it wasn't a priority among Republicans.
It was one of the top priorities of Governor Daniels.
Now, was it?
Why was it
in shambles when he left?
Because we hired 800 new caseworkers on day one.
And
he created the Department of Child Services.
Right,
as a standalone agency.
Right. And then Pence came in and made his changes, and the problem continued, and the problem grew.
You know a lot of this.
They didn't work.
We couldn't anticipate.
They've made some progress now. That's right.
Spikes so high.
Well, you knew we had an opioid epidemic before last year. Okay, we've known that for years and years and years, and no action was taken. So they are finally starting to address a number of the problems. Let's hope they continue with the funding and don't, when the light of scrutiny comes off the agency, they don't start cutting it again, because they keep thinking that the state is a bank and it's not there to protect its citizens.
We talked about this when it first started to come out, all the way back when Bonaventura's letter was first released and since then, as something that could come back on the political side to hurt Eric Holcomb when he inevitably probably makes his reelection bid in 2020. Has his handling of this over the course of 2018 negated any sort of threat to him?
I think he's handled it pretty deftly. And there are a lot of things going on that aren't like big sexy headlines, but, you know, within the agency on mentoring and decentralization and things like that. The only slight question I have is I'm not clear on what metric we're going to use to decide whether it's successful, all the stuff we're doing. Like, is it successful just if our caseload goes down? Is it successful just if we spend less money? Is it successful if we have fewer child deaths? Obviously, that's a big one.
That's always successful.
But, you know, I just don't know how we judge it numerically, say, next year when we're looking at it.
That's a good question, because we have the same problem with charter schools. We fund and fund and fund, but we don't look to see whether any of that additional money going in different ways to all of the different reform choice ideas has made one whit of difference in education.
I think it's especially true with DCS. I think your point is well taken there, because some state agencies, they can, the scoreboard can light up for them. If economic development officials land 1,000 job factory or some, you know, big bump up in employment in Indiana, they can pat themselves on the back. People can say, hey, we. This is an agency where the scoreboard doesn't really light up, because I think the assumption is if kids don't die and kids are being cared for and fed and nourished at a basic level, well, that's what the agency is supposed to do.
And the reality is you're probably never going to get to zero child deaths. It's just,
well, the agency can only, you know, score a loss. It can't ever score a win, which is I don't mean that in any way that, I mean, I think it has improved, and I'm sure it will continue to improve. I think it's headed in the right direction.
It's hard to see the wins.
You don't, yeah, well, nobody, they don't get credit for it, I guess is what I'm saying.
You have problems other than the child death. I mean, the opioid crisis has meant that many of the children born to addicted parents have huge problems, which will explode the Medicaid budget and all, but make
life. Well,
that's
actually one of the reforms. They embed Medicaid in that agency.
Right.
Yeah, which they've done.
But yeah. What will happen is that those children are going to face a lifetime of hardship, and we've got to do something to intervene on that before those children are born.
And to credit to Governor Holcomb, that's one of the items on his legislative agenda for this year, is he wants to have the verbal screen for all pregnant mothers to try and figure out, are you addicted to a substance, and then let's try to get them help before that child is born, and hopefully some of that damage gets worse. Well, there was perhaps no more controversial name in 2018 than Attorney General Curtis Hill. Four women, a state lawmaker, and three legislative staffers say Hill groped them at a post-session party in March. Those allegations came to light in July. Now, Hill has remained defiant. He says he did absolutely nothing wrong and that he won't leave office, despite calls to resign from the governor and legislative leaders. A special prosecutor decided not to bring criminal charges, and legislative leaders say they won't do anything more about this situation. Republican legislative leaders say that, even as Hill faces a potential civil suit from the four victims. Now, John Schwanes, how much will 2018 affect Curtis Hill in 2020 if he runs for re-election?
I don't know how a situation like this can't affect his re-election bid. When you have the governor and legislative leadership of your own party, that's a tough situation. Now, if this had been a situation where all of the accusers had been, say, Democratic staffers or Democratic lawmakers, and there was some sense that there was a partisan agenda here, which clearly isn't. Nobody's saying that, because we do have a cross-section of women who have come forward. But if that were the case, then he probably could try to use it as a rallying cry and say, look what these people are doing. They're trying to tear down a good...
It's the insulated powers of Indianapolis,
right,
who are out to get it.
Well, I just don't know if it's as effective when it's not partisan as it could be. He might have some success with rallying circling the wagons if, in fact, he could make the case that it was partisan.
Quite frankly, how much, I mean, it will obviously get talked about. There's no question about that. But will it really hurt him all that much in 2020?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, especially since it's a convention fight. I mean, he really only has to sway, what, like 500 or 600 people? I mean, that's a far different cry. And he can do the whole me against the man, you know, they're trying to keep me down. And to be fair, both Republicans and Democrats I've talked to over this past year, you know, they do question, and some of it is generational. Some people see that he did nothing wrong. And so, you know, that'll be interesting to see when you got a private vote on that.
Well, you shame on the Republican Party if they nominate him for Attorney General again. I mean, just shame on them. The only way it seems to me it has any effect on him for another political office in 2020 is if he decides to run. not in the convention, but maybe to challenge Holcomb or something for the governorship. But shame on the Republican Party if they allow him to be nominated again, because this stuff happened. It was not made up. Generation doesn't excuse it. It's inexcusable conduct, particularly in a statewide elected official and the highest law enforcement officer in the state of Indiana. So,
Nick, he's absolutely right. Now, a lot of the statements that have come out from the Inspector General's report to what Republican legislative leaders have said is it's in the hands of the voters now. They're the ones who are going to decide how much this matters. That's true if he gets to November. But we have a convention fight, theoretically, in earlier than that over this. And how does that play out in your mind?
He has been very effective at this kind of me again. I'm down here in Indianapolis. I'm from Elkhart. It's me against the world. Look what they're doing to me. And we saw some of that play out in the convention this past summer. Nikki's right, and she's close on the math. I think it's probably going to be 800 people. If it's head-to-head, it'd be 800 people that he's really got to sway. And there's 800 people outstate Indiana that delegates who are going to think maybe he's just getting hosed here. We'll see how that goes. What is not effective at conventions is a heavy hand, top-down party leaders approach where we tell these delegates, these 1,500 or so delegates, that here's the program. You're going to come and vote against Curtis Hill. That is not going to work. They're going to have to come to Indianapolis and watch this story play out. The latest version of this was the $100,000 he may or may not have planned to spend of taxpayer dollars on his legal defense, for example.
A long time between now and the
party. These delegates are going to have to convince themselves that this is unacceptable behavior, that it did happen, that it can't be allowed. Now, lightning has struck in general elections before, like Linda Ritz, on these down-ballot races where it's high-profile, just high-profile enough for people to pay attention to it.
So you're telling us we're going to win the attorney general's race if you nominate him?
I'm saying you got a chance.
I don't think we have a chance. I think we win it.
I don't think that's right. You're foolish enough to nominate him again. You put some real goofballs up for attorney general the last couple of cycles, but it's not inconceivable that voters could still be thinking about this when they go down that ballot. It's unusual and it's unlikely, but
it's also
after the
balloting
at the convention, do we see that, you know, obligatory photo where the governor and every other candidate is raised with raised hands up at the.
I think you should show.
I'm not disclosing how we choreograph these things.
I want to just see how that plays out. There may be a little. There might be some distance there. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, two events from the 2018 legislative session stand out: lawmakers finally lifting the ban on Sunday alcohol carryout sales, and then the very close of the regular session. The midnight deadline in mid-March for the 2018 session came with a bang, as several pieces of legislation fell by the wayside. It prompted a one-day special session 2 months later. Nikki Kelly, will the 2018 session be remembered more for Sunday sales or for that clock striking midnight?
Okay, first of all, I'm very upset that you left out the Say's Firefly
as the top designation of the year. It was so long ago.
Right on the heels of the sugar cream pie.
Absolutely.
We never passed that.
Sunday, no. Absolutely.
Jerry Tor is going to write you a letter now.
Sunday sales is the big win for most Hoosiers. And you know, only us political junkies really, you know, got all that chaotic ending there at the session. It got all of our adrenaline up, but it was kind of forgotten
a month
later. Really
excited if you're a total dork, which we are.
Exactly.
I thought it was awesome, or at least fascinating.
Fascinating.
Obviously, we talked about this a little when the session ended, but lawmakers did, as they always do, pass hundreds of bills. They got a lot done, especially on the workforce development front. We hope that it's heading in the right direction, certainly for the good of the state, but really it's about alcohol, and that's the end of the story.
And tax cuts for corporations.
I mean, if you did a poll right now on the streets about, what impact did the final frantic minutes of the 2018 session have on you, most people would probably look at you and say, session 28, what are we even talking about?
Yeah. Not viewers of this show, though.
Not viewers of this show, that's a special kind of premium group.
Cut above,
exactly. Are we done fawning and pandering? But it's
never
new year after all. But no, it's. I think, if in terms of what actually affected Joe and Joanne voter, it's the alcohol sales.
That'll be alcohol that everybody remembers and celebrates.
Yeah, but in some ways, this was exactly what a short session is supposed to be. It was technical corrections, which nobody can talk about, but it has to happen. It was reconciliation of the Indiana tax code following federal tax reform. It was substantive investments in school safety and training. And the things they dealt with in the special session could have been really the only things that were dealt with if you go through kind of the whole list, absent Sunday sales. But I don't know. In some ways, this is exactly what the short session is supposed to be. And now the long session is going to really make up for that in terms of issues because we're not going to have enough time. 30 minutes.
Right. Yeah. They're going to attack everything.
A way to deal with emergency issues,
right.
Like not being able to buy alcohol.
I was just going to say, doesn't that qualify as an emergency issue?
I guess
for
it did.
Depends
who
you are. I mean, only
if you don't plan ahead.
In a pinch, it is an emergency.
Wow.
It was alcohol that will last.
It's alcohol that people will remember. I think you're right about that. I think one of the impact of that $180 million tax cut that was done under the rug when you're talking about not being able to pay teachers more than $32,000 a year, that looms pretty large out there. Sorry.
And that is ongoing money that could have been used.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. All right. Now, as you look back at 2018, who is your biggest winner in the Hoosier political scene? We'll start with you. And Elaine.
I'd say the House Democratic Caucus. They elected 9 people. The majority of them, or almost all of them, are either first-time candidates, millennials, or women, which diversified the caucus considerably.
I believe they now have a majority women in the caucus.
Yeah, which is pretty darn good, isn't it? Maybe not from your perspective, but from Nikki and my perspective, it's pretty good.
I think it's pretty good,
yeah.
Michael Bryan, who's your biggest winner of 2018?
It's clearly Mike Braun, I think. In the Indiana Republican Party, we had record dollars coming in. We had record voter contacts. Every metric of engagement, we broke records as a state party for the cause of electing Mike Braun. And there was a wave to some extent nationwide, certainly in the House of Representatives. And Republicans had a good map in the U.S. Senate, and we were able to kind of survive that right at the national level. In Indiana, Democrats won in some areas where they never should have lost, some seats in Northwest Indiana and Marion County in the state Senate. But so I think we withstood that, and I think in part because of the story we've been able to tell and the accomplishments that the state Republicans have been able to make here. And voters, we know, distinguish what's happening maybe nationwide that they're not happy with,
well,
but what's happened in Indiana.
Let's not forget gerrymandering by computer, which is really the reason that you have the margins you have.
We won these majorities on your maps, Ann.
Uh-uh.
Oh, yeah, we did.
Yes,
we did.
Yeah, but you...
We had a 20-seat margin on your maps.
Right. But
this is a generational chance to be identified as Republicans.
Now we get 40% of the state Senate vote, and you have how many? We have 20% of the seats. That's on your map.
Who's your biggest winner of 2018?
I'd say Mike Braun, not only because of what he accomplished in November... I'd say the tougher battle in many ways for him was the May primary because he was going up against 2 incumbent members of the U.S. House of Representatives. And
you say that like it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, I would just say you could argue that there was some wave that the Trump visits helped him. But when it was just the primary, that was Mike Braun in his blue shirt. Maybe it's the blue shirt concessions that are going to be the big
money.
Winner here. I don't know. Yeah,
the big winner of 2018 is the blue shirt.
The work shirt. Blue work shirt.
Indiana Republican Party. They maintained majorities in the House and Senate. They got a Senate seat, U.S. Senate seat. I think they are the winners.
Now, we got to do the flip side. Who's the biggest loser of 2018? And this time we're starting with you, Mike O'Brien.
I think Democrats are going to have a real hard time looking to 2020 and seeing where they make any gains. There's not even a good short list right now who's going to run for some of these congressional seats, who's going to run for governor, who's going to run for these other big seats that are up. It's almost a generational reset that they've got to look. And they do have some great young people. A guy like Ryan Hatfield, some of these young guys they have are really impressive young lawmakers or young mayors. So it's not, I think Republicans are going to be in a bad spot if we ever think, they can't ever make it back. But there's some bright spots in the party, but they've got to look at it as a decades-long project.
I'd put Susan Brooks right up there. I mean, she won the election, okay?
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
Biggest loser? Yeah,
okay.
And the reason why is the Republicans have a problem with women. That's clear, all right? They can't elect them. They don't run them. And when they get them there, she was in a position of a fairly good position, and she obviously did that Benghazi nonsense to ingratiate herself with the leadership, and now they demote her. They only have 13 women in Congress, and they demote her. That's a losing proposition.
2 of them from Indiana.
Yeah, there may be 2 from Indiana, but the 2 are irrelevant.
We have 1 white guy in our statewide offices.
And
all the rest are women.
Mm-hmm. I think it's clearly Joe Donnelly. I think losing that Senate seat was a huge blow.
I'd say I agree. Joe Donnelly, not because of any shortcoming on his part, either in his tenure in the Senate or in the campaign. I think he did everything he could do and was smart about the campaign and the numbers, and the fairly narrow margin showed that. But when you're the incumbent U.S. senator and you lose, that's by definition a big deal.
Well, finally, as we approach 2019, as I asked last year, what do you think Indiana's New Year's resolution should be? Quickly, John Schwannis.
Let's get that IU National Basketball Championship back again this year.
Nikki Kelly.
Oh, God, I have no idea. Let's resolve to give teachers a pay raise.
There you go. That's a good
one. So
I think we should resolve to stop acting like a bank and start investing in teachers, in preschool, in kindergarten, in general, in this state, in infrastructure.
And Mike O'Brien, you've got the last word.
I'm going to resolve to be kinder to Ann. I've been so mean to her
really,
the whole year.
You know, that's a good thing. Nice. Would you mind writing that down?
I'm not sure.
It on TV.
I'm not sure that's going to go the other way for you.
Consider the source. He's a dork. He already identified himself. So
that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette.
And that's Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith with Indiana Week in Review for this program today. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Scott Miley is the Indiana State House reporter for an organization called CNHI, which is a nationwide organization of community newspapers, including three here in Indiana, Tribune Star in Terre Haute, the Herald Bulletin in Anderson, and the Kokomo Tribune. And Scott's been working on a series of articles, and continuing series, actually, dealing with township governments. And one of these articles has come out here recently, deals with the the average township government in Indiana holding a rather sizable balance in their budgets. And to go into more detail, we have Scott Miley with us from Indianapolis. Scott, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Sure, Chris.
Well, kind of set things up here, if you will. Tell us a little bit about the series of articles that you are working on, and more articles are coming out in the newspapers within the group, and how they pertain to Indiana government and how government in townships in particular seem to be run.
We had talked. We have had an editor's meeting last year and talked about updating the system of township government in Indiana. Every township, all 1,005 townships, have a trustee, and almost all have advisory boards, which are composed of three members. It goes back to 2007. When then Governor Mitch Daniels formed a commission with Chief Justice Randy Shepard and former Governor Joe Kernan to look at government reform. And it's known as the Kernan-Shepard Report, and they came up with 27 recommendations. One of them was combining township services into county units of government. For example, one of the services trustees offers is poor relief to people who need emergency help for housing, utility, and food. So we started looking at those costs and found some, I guess, staggering numbers in particularly in the surpluses that the townships have.
Did you determine in looking at the record and some of these budgets that you had to, and we'll go into more detail about this, that not all townships in Indiana have surpluses this large or any surpluses really at all?
Yes. There are some. some didn't report their numbers to the state, as they should have, but there are some down to 9%, 17%. As far as a surplus over their certified budget. We had talked to some experts. No one wants to actually state what the percentage is for a rainy day fund or how much you should have in excess.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, if you look at the state has $1.8 billion in reserve. And that's about 11%, 12% of the budget. So we kind of went off of that. We asked a number of officials what should be a good number. And they thought, you know, you got to have a 3-month balance for emergency situations. Other townships are saving up to buy a fire truck or to build a fire station. So there's a number of reasons that justify the holdings, but we talked to some who just had no idea what they were going to do with the money they have saved up.
Have they set up, I guess, some way, some resolution or some legal means to be able to keep track of this extra money, create this rainy day fund in many cases?
They keep track of them just through the State Board of Accounts and the Department of Local Government Finance in their annual budgets. For example, I think overall, if you take in all township certified budgets, and they're certified by the state, there's $390 million last year, total mm-hmm. budgets. But their balance, you know, the amount that they had saved up amounts to $453 million. So that's, if you add that together, that's 116% over their budget. Like we said, some are, you know, planning ahead and know what to do, but many can't tell you what they want to do. So a state representative from Batesville, her name is Cindy Zemke, she's a Republican, and she has tried to reform township government in the past with just minor success. This time she's going to go after the surpluses. And she would like, although the bill hasn't been published yet, they're going to be published yet this week, she will ask for townships to be required to submit a capital improvement plan that lists what they plan to do with surpluses. And that will have to be filed with the state. If it's not, then there'll be some mechanism that they won't get their money.
Does her recommended measure that comes up here before the General Assembly this session just continue on with this effort that has been followed, I guess, going all the way back to the Kernan Shepherd Commission during the Mitch Daniels era, that to try to either control or even abolish townships in Indiana?
I think she certainly would like to control them, because she's introduced bills in the past that would in fact, this last session, back in early 2018, she introduced a bill that would force townships with populations under 1,200 residents to merge or consolidate with a neighboring township. She thought that would be a way to make government more efficient and might cost less to administer township services.
In your research, do you feel that she's trying to not only to keep a closer handle financially on townships, certainly within her area, because she's in southeastern Indiana, but as a way to follow through on the Kernan Shepherd Commission recommendations to kind of rein in the number of townships in the state?
Yes, I think so. I think she was very influenced by the Kernan Shepherd report. I can't remember the first year that she ran, but the report had already been out, and she was very influenced by the attempts for local government reform. It had the report had minimal impact, although it did lead to the removal of the property assessment functions from townships.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, it was just a few years ago that they were combined into county assessor offices, and that provides a more uniform property tax assessment. So that was one good thing out of the report. And I think Zemke and others, she's not the only one, but she's the one who turns out to be the author on some of the bills. Representative Jerry Torr, Republican out of Carmel, has also been on these bills that want to tighten up government expenses.
We're talking with Scott Miley. He's the State House reporter for the CNHI, a group of community newspapers across the country, and particularly here in Indiana, three newspapers, Terre Haute and Anderson and Kokomo among them. Are you finding in the research that you're doing for your series of articles about townships in Indiana that, that there are some other efforts that are underway to keep track of what township spending is like, and in turn, that would in turn maybe not only educate readers for the newspapers that you work for, but also citizens in Indiana that may in turn lead to smaller townships and better run governments?
Yes, there. In fact, there was a I ran across one gentleman down in in southeastern Indiana, who has been trying to get three township trustees to talk about merging their services so that it might be able to attract new business and industry to the area. And he's been working on this for a number of months. I talked to him the first time he was publicizing the effort back in, I think, April. And so there are smaller attempts, but for the most part, a lot of the initial interest from the Kernan Shepherd report died down because it just got too much opposition from Indiana Farm Bureau is one of those that's been against consolidation. The Indiana Township Association, which represents about 600-700 of the townships, was also against it up until this last session, when they initially went along with Zemke's attempt to consolidate townships under 1,200 population. But within a few weeks, they also ended up opposing it because the Indiana Volunteer Firefighters Association got involved. So there's a number of very strong groups out there that are opposing the consolidation. I'm not so sure so many will oppose the Representative Zemke's capital improvement plan. I think many of them that I've talked to realize that it's one way to justify to taxpayers their budgets.
Do you also see, too, that there'll be some movement from the state government? We know that the Department of Local Government Finance is keeping an eye on this, I'm sure, very closely, and this is the State Board of Accounts. They already have some control, I guess, within their own statutes to be able to keep track of how county government keeps track of their money and grows as well.
They do. They're excellent at keeping track of the monies, but they don't have an enforcement arm. If a trustee takes off, let's say, and we're writing about some of these, a trustee taking off with writing herself checks, mm-hmm, for her own personal use, they don't have, the State Board of Accounts and Department of Local Government Finance don't have enforcement arms to go after them. Instead, the State Board of Accounts will turn over their report to a local prosecutor who can then decide what to do with it. And also the Indiana Attorney General's office can file a civil suit seeking damages. So it gets kind of convoluted, but this way with Zemke's new bill, it might add a little bit of enforcement, at least control over when the townships get their budget or get their funding.
Yeah. And we know for sure here in Northwest Indiana in particular, there have been concerns. There have been, of course, long-standing concerns about public corruption issues. And it's come down now to the township level in some cases. Calumet Township and some other townships, certainly here in our region, are keeping a close eye on this, because I'm sure that they feel that if this measure that Representative Zemke is proposing could very well clamp down on some of the issues that they keep bringing up or have being brought up in turn with these local audits, I'm sure.
Yes, and Calumet's a really interesting case in that they're pulling out, or that Griffith is pulling out, mm-hmm, of the township. I need to read further about that to see who's going to be covering the services that the township provided, but that's a really interesting case, and that's what a lot of the townships face, is that, well, if I merge with my neighbor, then who's going to pay for fire services, or who gets the fire truck? Who gets the station? It comes down to that kind of political argument.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of interesting questions, certainly that the cases here in Northwest Indiana are bringing up, and there are probably a lot of townships across Indiana, including within the area that you cover, the newspapers that you work for, that are keeping a close eye on what Northwest Indiana townships are doing.
Yes, and it's one way we hope of, you know, educating Hoosiers, too, who really don't seem to know much about their township government. We took a survey. In fact, we did two surveys, and in one of them, of 560 Hoosiers, we found that 82% could not identify their township trustee, but 71% thought that the township duties should be moved to a county agency. So we weren't real sure what that meant. It seemed like some were aware of it, whereas 82% couldn't name their trustee.
No, it sounds like more education is needed, and it's certainly going to come about. And representing your newspapers will do their part to be able to help your readers in your particular area be able to get that information and in turn educate them and maybe strengthen what efforts that Representative Zimke is trying to do on a statewide level, to be sure. Scott, thank you for spending some time and going over this, and we'll keep an eye out for more articles that you're continuing in your series that you're representing in the newspapers that you put out for Terre Haute, for Anderson, as well as for Kokomo. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris.
Scott Miley is a State House reporter. He's the correspondent for the CNHI community newspapers, which include newspapers in Anderson, Kokomo, and in Terre Haute. This is Regionally Speaking. Industry and East Chicago have gone hand-in-hand for more than a century, and nowhere is it more evident than in the city's historic planned worker community, Marktown. The neighborhood is sandwiched between a steel mill and one of the nation's largest oil refineries, BP. The company for years has been buying homes and buildings in Marktown and clearing them away. Many remaining residents want to leave too, but they say that BP has been offering them way less than what their homes are worth. Reporter Michael Puente offers this look as to what's happening in the historic neighborhood near the refinery.
Ricardo Maldonado offers coffee and pastries to his neighbors. They gather in his dining room last week to discuss their homes and their future in this neighborhood called Marktown. It was built more than a century ago by industrialist Clayton Mark so workers could live near his factory. Marktown's unique Tudor-style English homes are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But let's not over-romanticize this place. Although the rent and home prices are affordable, it can be hard to live here. It's isolated from the rest of the city of East Chicago. No grocery stores, no schools within walking distance. Residents say the worst part is the air quality. That's Olivia Chalwance. She's lived in the neighborhood with her husband Juan and their two children for 7 years. She says in Spanish, who wants to live here near so much contamination, the contamination and the odor? Here, Olivia says she prohibits her children from playing outside because of the pollution. Olivia says she and her neighbors want to move, but BP isn't offering enough money for their homes.
This house, you know, I paid $30,000, and I put $20,000 because I fix it.
This is Ricardo Maldonado, whose house we are in. He bought his home 14 years ago, and he thinks it's worth much more now.
And I don't think it's fair if they offer me $30,000, you know. I think something fair is around 50 or 60, something like that.
BP has offered, in my opinion, a very unjust and unfair value that goes from $20,000 and in some cases $30,000.
Juan Villarreal is a licensed real estate broker who's representing 26 of the remaining 60 or so homeowners in their dealings with BP. Marktown once had more than 200 homes and duplexes, but many have been torn down over the years and their occupants relocated. Villarreal says some homeowners aren't allowed to talk about their dealings with BP. They often make decisions in the dark.
Sometimes we're given an ultimatum by brokers that represent BP, suggesting that if they didn't take the offer now, which would be on an average of $20,000 to $30,000, $100,000, that they would be lucky if BP would even offer them half. And so there's a lot of scare tactics.
BP's Director of Media Affairs, Michael Abenhoff, says in a statement that the company has been purchasing property around the refinery for more than 20 years in an effort to create more green space. That means clearing away the historic structures and potentially displacing residents. In his statement, Abenhoff says in all cases, the properties were purchased from willing sellers. Where there were safety hazards, BP had the purchased properties demolished or removed, he says. Abenhoff insists BP always negotiates in good faith. East Chicago City Councilman Robert Garcia, who represents Marktown, thinks otherwise.
BP just don't understand. Them homes might not be worth much, but a lot of those residents and homeowners have their homes paid off, and that's priceless to them.
The company hasn't said why it wants to clear the homes, but local environmental activist Thomas Frank has an idea. He says after the fatal explosion at BP's Texas City refinery in 2005, the company wants a buffer between its facility and residential areas.
They're mitigating against the potential for a blast.
Frank says it will be difficult to find a home anywhere for the amount BP is offering.
Where do you go from Marktown? And you're just not going to find a home that you can buy at $14,000 and not have to pay enormous amount of mortgage.
Marktown homeowner Juan Rivas faces that real possibility.
Si no, ¿para dónde nos vamos a ir?
He says, where are we going? With $20,000, we won't get anything. I'm Michael Puente.
This Friday, here we go again on Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick. We're bringing in a new operation right out of Crown Point. The holidays are over. We ate all that pasta and sweets, and I know I had a lot of baklava. So it's time to lose that weight, get some energy, and you know it's a cold and flu season, so we need something for our immune system. What better people to bring in? Generation Nutrition. It's a brand new operation. The owner, Jennifer, and her manager, Cindy, will be in to talk about all the benefits of going into their operation and getting one of those great, delicious nutrition drinks. Call in 769-9577 and get a gift card from Generation Nutrition or Chef Nick's Eatery out of Winfield. Call in 769-9577. If you want to lose some weight, get some energy, and protect your immune system, call in to Let's Eat this Friday at 3 o'clock on WLPR, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Getting the right treatment for a child who has autism can be tough, and parents run into the same problems for a child who has a mental illness. So imagine what happens when a child has autism and is mentally ill. Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert has the story for us of one woman's fight to help her son.
Yvonne Martin keeps detailed notes of 2 years in her life. It starts on March 1st, 2016. That's the day her son, Daniel, first ran away from the family's home near Evansville, Indiana. He was 13. She reads one entry.
Danny's parents called 911 in a state of panic. After several hours, search and rescue is contacted, and there is suspicion that he was in the Ohio River.
It was one of the scariest things she's ever experienced.
No parent wants to hear that we're now going to search for your child in the river because we can't find him.
Danny has autism and a post-traumatic stress disorder. He's what some call a dually diagnosed child. Yvonne's timeline logs the outbursts, calls to police, trips to acute treatment centers, and the talks with state agencies to get care for Danny. But she couldn't find residential treatment for Danny, and he took a major turn for the worse on the evening of July 22nd, 2017.
And I went up to give him something, and he came out of his bedroom, and the first thing he did was he hit me.
She and her husband went outside and called 911.
And the officer went in. I said, he's autistic. Please don't touch him. You don't touch an autistic person.
Despite her pleas, Yvonne says an officer ordered Danny to put his hands behind his back.
He just stood there looking at her. She grabbed him to try to turn him around. And that's when he fought. Then two more cops came into the house. And we heard, stop fighting. We heard one of them yell, he's going for my gun.
She says police threatened to shoot, but eventually subdued Danny and put him in handcuffs. He ended up in a juvenile detention facility for over a year. Yvonne was glad Danny was safe, and he got some therapy and special education services, but she believes it wasn't enough. Looking back, she also wonders if this whole situation could have been avoided if Danny only had found care sooner. Yvonne calls it a game of hot potato. She says every state agency she contacted would say it couldn't help Danny. She'd be told to call someone else. Finding a residential treatment center was a similar story.
That is absolutely an issue where, you know, we see consumers punted back and forth between providers, often on the basis that, you know, they're claiming they're not equipped to handle that individual.
Justin Schrock is a lawyer with Indiana Disability Rights who helped the family seek care. He says state mental health services are often siloed. It makes finding care difficult for people like Danny who need more than one type of service. Yvonne says autism treatment centers wouldn't take him because he's high functioning, and treatment centers for general mental illness would say they aren't equipped to provide services to children with autism. The state acknowledges that there are gaps in care for people with very specific mental health care needs. A spokesperson says a new facility set to open in Indianapolis later this year has a unit designed for children with autism, which may help fill some of those gaps. Amy DeVries also wants to fill those gaps. She leads Congregations Acting for Justice and Empowerment, and she's heard similar stories from parents of children all across the autism spectrum.
And it's not just residential. We're looking at outpatient services, acute care, which would be, in our case, Deaconess Cross Point. If a neurotypical child is suicidal or homicidal, they would be admitted to Deaconess Cross Point, but that autism diagnosis, 9 times out of 10, gets them excluded.
Deaconess Cross Point is the area's only inpatient acute mental health care center for children. But the chief administrator says it's not a good match for many children with autism. It can be noisy and stressful. Meanwhile, Danny did find treatment. After his parents convinced the state that there was no residential facility here that would help him, they were able to send him to St. Louis, around 150 miles away. Yvonne and her husband have visited. Danny recently turned 16, and Yvonne shows me pictures of his birthday cake.
He got to share it with the other boys he lives with in the cottage. And then what we ended up getting him was a Nintendo Switch.
And most importantly, he has the care he needs. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our reporters for joining us as well. From Indianapolis, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith and his guests on Indiana Week in Review. From the CNHI Community Newspapers, State House reporter Scott Miley, our own area reporter Michael Puente, and Side Effect Public Media's Isaiah Seibert. We'll be back with you on Monday.